Matt Easton is the founding member of a band called The Jenny Thing, another band that I was really kind of unfamiliar with. I had heard their name before, and I know they were out earlier in life, and disbanded. Life got in the way, and they are back together, and they're doing a new song, a new album, I should say, called American Canyon, and that is coming out on June 18th. So we're going to feature some songs for the first time on radio from the American Canyon album, from The Jenny Thing, as we welcome Matt Easton joining us in just a few moments. So let's check out the title track. This is American Canyon. New music, American Canyon. Sounding like we're at the Church of Rock and Roll there. I love that ending. American Canyon is the title track to the new album from The Jenny Thing, a band you might have heard of before. They'd been around for a while. They took a little break, and now they're back with this new album. And we've got the man who is in charge of so much of that, the guitarist, vocalist, writer, and founding member, Matt Easton, joining us now on the Midwest Beat. Matt, thank you.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, glad to be on with you. Thanks very much.
This album has such a unique sound. It's got the 90s thing. It's got the techno, darkness, rock, synth-based. It's very, very hard to describe. It certainly stands out from most of what's being made today. What was it that got you guys together, first of all, back in 91? And you had an 8-year run. You had some albums out. You took a hiatus. I assume life got in the way at some point. But you're back. So let's talk about what brought you together the first time and why it's the right time now to bring The Jenny Thing back to fruition.
Yeah, Yeah, cool. Yeah. Well, I mean, the band sort of has two starting points. One is childhood friendships. And I've known Mike Phillips, the drummer in the band, since I was born. Our parents were and are friends. And I've known Aaron, the bass player, since I was in junior high. And then the sort of writing genesis, the creative core, or the creating core, the writing group, was me and Shyam. And I met Shyam in college. So that now goes back a really long way. Like, mm-hmm. The guy I've known the shortest is, you know, we have a 30-year history. That's the short history of the Jenny thing. The long history is 48 years.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Well,
and then from there, why we got together now, you know, really gathering around the making process, around the songs themselves, and kind of a whole new approach to making songs, but okay. Also that classic chemistry between me and Shyam Rao, our guitarist and multi-instrumentalist, and the other half of the songwriting team.
The sound that you guys had was the sound of that period of the 90s. There were so many groups that had that techno synth thing. It wasn't like the synth bands of the 80s, you know, the Flock of Seagulls stuff. That was so poppy, but you guys got a little darker edge, a little more topical, a little more impacting, if you will. Why did it stop in 99? You guys should have been at the peak at that point. And obviously you're still friends. You had a long friendship before. You've got friendship now. Why was it the right time to take a break?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, we sort of ran our course as a club band and very guitar-based. And actually the synths were not forward at all. Although we grew up synth lovers. And, you know, like my childhood bedroom had no guitars and like four keyboards in it, hooked up to a computer.
Okay.
So, and then when I grew up, so to speak, when I became, you know, older teenager, young adult, I got really into guitar. So our band was actually fairly traditional, and the sound of us at that time would be kind of, you know, an American take on the Smiths and the Cure and that kind of thing, which maybe put us in the zone of Toad the Wet Sprocket or something like that, or the band that we got attached, you know, or that we were connected with as an opening act with Gin Blossoms, you know. So in a way, we made a big departure. Not in a way, we did make a big departure on this record, where we sort of looked back through our 90s sensibility back into the 80s and blended them.
Okay. So this album is a lot different than anyone that might have followed you back in the day.
It's pretty different. Yeah, yeah. We actually put out a guitar-oriented song as the first single, almost like a pre-single. We put out that probably, you know, 6 or 8 months ago to kind mm-hmm. of test the waters. But it was also self-consciously a song that featured both kind of a chimey electric guitar and some acoustic strumming. But I think actually that's the only song that features any strumming at all. And I barely played guitar. I was thinking about it the other day. I think I played guitar that is in the final version of the album on just two songs. So there's it's very guitar bare overall. And in fact, American Canyon, which you just played for everyone here, has no guitar on it, period.
Right.
It's a rock and roll song minus guitar. It's sort of our charter for the song American Canyon.
So the first single was which song? Was that Paper Angel?
First single was Lightfield.
Yeah. Lightfield.
Yeah.
Okay. And was that kind of like a reintroduction to the old sound, but with a new twist?
Yeah. Yeah. It was very consciously more kind of, you could see the singer-songwriter, you know, bones to it more clearly, whereas most of the songs on here, many of them are written on guitar, and the guitar is literally deleted. And it's rebuilt around kind of a new blueprint. Okay. So yeah, that was one where we kept the guitar, and you can really hear our kind of older signature sound blended with a lot of synth and a lot of edited drums and things that are a little bit less traditional.
All right. Well, let's play that one now. Let's play Lightfield, which was the first single, and then we're going to come back. We're going to talk some more and play some more music from this incredible album. Matt Easton is my guest. The Jenny Thing is the band, and this is another new one. First single, Lightfield.
Thank you.
Lightfield, new music, The Jenny Thing, that's off American Canyon. My guest is Matt Easton, founding member of the band, evolving in their sound, and that is a transitional song, as Matt said. Brings back the old sound with some of the new sound in there. Why was this the good time, Matt, that you guys said, maybe we should do this again?
Yeah, I mean, really, it's sort of just working at the speed of life, I guess. I think, you know, the band sort of produces, you know, first the seeds of songs, and then the songs, and then the sounds, and the completed work. And, you know, the front end of that is me and Sean working together. So he was actually in a couple places around the country, Southern California and the Midwest and then New York City, and then ended up relocating back into Northern California about 2015. And that was really the critical thing, because we would do a little bit of slow sharing of ideas with each other, but no real work over the years. And once he was here, we would get in the same room and, you know, move each other's demos forward and also just jam in a room together or generate from scratch, you know, brand new stuff. The song that comes to mind like that was the song American Canyon itself, which came really, really quickly, all in one day, and had a whole sound and kind of like a space that it existed in and a weight to it. And that really woke us up. It was like, oh, this one's actually good enough that we've got to put in work, you know, to get that last 10% out of it and then raise the standards for everything else that we've been fooling around with. And even to thin the herd, right? So it was an amount of throwing away stuff and also rebuilding stuff into this standard and really also into the sound and the story of the record, or the place, I might say. The storyline is sort of spotty, but there's an arc to it. But I would say it feels like a place, and it's supposed to feel like a place.
Mm-hmm. Now, with you guys were all staying with music, just not together. You were still writing individually, and then coming back together is when it all kind of came to fruition.
Yeah, I mean, not with tons of seriousness. I had a period where I was writing very actively and demoing, and I put out a solo record and stuff like that. Played a few shows, and then it was just sort of on cruise control. You know, like I play piano almost every day and guitar every other day, and music's a big part of my life, but the idea of really kind of getting back in the workshop and like building something very intentional and kind of ambitious, I mean, I think this record is, there's a lot of kind of drive that went into it, that really came back to us around a couple of songs, and then sort of you know, spread to the rest of them, and then you get this record, you know. So I mean, we're inspired by the creative process when it's popping, and I think a lot of it has to do with the long term friendship and the chemistry between me and Shama's writers, and then the thrill of the hunt. Like once you think there's something that's going to turn into like a real artifact, you know, it's not just a songlet, it's not just a sort of a little sweet bite. It's actually like a bigger artifact.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we get really amped up. And I think that totally happened on this record. We got really amped up and started chasing it down.
Now, were these songs all done basically at the same time with this album in mind? Because they do work together so well.
Yeah, I mean, they were, some of them were written going back a number of years, but then were rewritten.
Okay.
Sometimes very, very drastically. And then, you know, half of them were written in real time, kind of around the themes here. So, I mean, like, to break it down quickly, the three songs that carry kind of the theme of violence, essentially, are American Canyon, All in My Head, and Waiting for the Knife.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have songs that are sort of about, I don't know, forgiveness or graciousness. And those are, you know, More All the Time and Monsters of Mercy and Lightfield and Paper Angel. And then there's one called Aromatica, which is kind of the weird one.
That's the one we've got queued up because I love that song. Yeah,
oh,
I got
God.
That ready
oh,
to go oh, next. Cool. I was hoping you'd want to play that.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Well, I mean, talking about that, I mean, in the center of the album, there's a battle that the protagonist loses very, very badly beyond his wildest imagination. And in fact, the kind of thesis question of the album, and this is not a missaid statement or question. It is, what would it mean to be defeated beyond your wildest dreams? And the Battle of American Canyon, sort of in the center of the record, is for a really highly effective person to completely bottom out spontaneously in his life, and then to have to deal with the aftermath,
mm-hmm.
something he didn't think was even possible. And so American Canyon is about victory in defeat and vice versa. And it leaves you with Aromedica, which is a dilemma in having to maybe waste the lives of his people in battle. And then finally, Lightfield is sort of closes that out with this rescue scene where there's going to be this crazy ambulance driver who's based on Ernest Hemingway, who zooms in. He's like a space ambulance driver. He zooms in and actually takes the main character and his people on a rescue. He evacuates them against their will, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Into this place called the Lightfield. So you hear the characters talking about the Lightfield in advance with a lot of anxiety during Aromedica.
Aromedica is kind of like the aftermath of the battle and the chaos.
Correct.
The dust
yep.
is clearing, the smoke is clearing, and there's life, there's death, there's everything, and these guys are dealing with it.
It's
brilliant. This is the one that jumped out when I was playing this album the first time, and I thought, wow, this has some impact. So we're going to play that, and then we're going to be back with Matt and the Jenny thing. Listen to this. Listen to the words. Listen to the lyrics. Listen to the dialogue.
We lost so many last night. So many, so fast. We'll lose all our light in a couple of hours. Sooner than that, with all the dust and smoke.
Alive or dead, move as many as you can, as fast as you can, onto the lights. We'll be flying with the angels of the sky. If we go hard, we'll be within spitting distance of home in a day.
Thank you.
gone insane? Am I going insane? These are the only survivors.
You can't do this. You have no choice. We'll do our best to get everybody home. We'll do our best to get everybody home.
You can almost smell the gunpowder residue in the air, and you can see the dust and the smoke, and you can see these people picking up the bodies and moving them, and all in 3 minutes, it captures the visual. It's almost like having a video game in your head. That's Aeromedica?
Aeromedica, yeah.
Good stuff, and that is the new stuff that off the American Canyon album. This is the Jenny thing we're listening to, which actually is not out yet. It comes out on the 18th of this month, so just a few days away. That song, maybe why I embraced it so much, it reminds me a little bit of one of my favorite bands of all time, and that is Queensryche with the Mindcrime episodes, which was very conceptual. This album is not conceptual per se, but it's got like a mini conceptual segment in there, correct?
Yeah, it actually has a full concept that runs throughout.
Okay.
But I'm really conscious. I mean, I really hold myself to every single piece has to hold up. It has to stand as a single, stand as a pop song. I mean, I love pop songs. I love 4 minute songs. And if I'm going to go do something conceptual, it has to be on its own layer that doesn't sort of disrupt the consumability and sort of the form of a pop song or an album. You know, that's always a concern of mine. I really respect the album, like, you know, sort of like you respect a novel or a haiku, you know, just to make sure it works that way. So
who is Faraday?
Yeah, good question. No, I'd love that you're keying into the song too. And I'd love to hear more about it too. That the genesis of the song overall musically, I actually wrote it on an iPhone using GarageBand and creating those siren sounds on a plane. And the plane sounds were also recorded into the phone, and they're still on the track. So you're actually hearing a real airplane with me sitting, you know, in the middle of the night flying back from China, pulling in this soundscape. And that whining sound is me emulating the way the engines were revving up and down with a synthesizer sound, you know, with my finger on my iPhone screen.
That sounded a little bit to me almost like a theremin.
Yeah, it's very theremin. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a very unfretted, unpitched, trying to pitch sound. It's always falling behind and getting ahead. And it's both dissonant and satisfying within the harmonics of that song. But so I carried that around for like 5 years. And then I started sort of orchestrating it. And then I surprised the band. We reached a point where on and off we would be still writing or we would be finished with tracking what we'd already written. So the band likes to get together, right? So we get together some Saturday and, you know, in comes a guitar, in comes a bass. And I had that script written. So I surprised the group with the script and the mics are set up. It's like, we're doing a recording today, but you're talking. And so I kind of threw this at them and it was recorded that same day kind of as a surprise. But so that song's had an interesting life. But the Faraday character is connected to Michael Faraday, who was an English scientist. And some of the fascinating things about him are he's got a tile in the floor of Westminster Abbey in London, but he's not actually buried there. And he had a life that was marked by great talent, but also social stigma. He was not a gentleman, a scientist. Mm-hmm. He was actually a very religious person, lower class, and a very successful scientist in terms of doing science and getting data and creating theories about all of the light particles in the universe, which is what leads to light field. That was his theory, called the light field. So I got really fascinated with him as a sort of insider-outsider persona. And then the light field itself was this beautiful model. I think when they describe it succinctly, it is a mathematical formula that represents where all of the light in the universe is and is going.
Okay.
And I thought that was just like a beautiful piece of kind of physics and math to think about. So that was where Faraday came from. So yeah, I named what would be the Hemingway character, which is me talking, by the way, that's my voice. I imagined him as sort of a cocky, maybe drunk space ambulance driver, patterned after Hemingway, but named after Faraday.
Wow. This is, there's a lot of thought and a lot of background and a lot of effort put into this album. Was this all done pre-pandemic, or was this something that you were working on, at least in mixing or something, during the pandemic?
Yeah, the concept for the whole thing was pre-pandemic.
Okay.
We knew we would hit 2020 and make the last push to put the record out. And yet, of course, the pandemic, by the time March rolled around, was upon us. So the good thing about that was we only had a little more tracking to do, except for the lead vocals, which, you know, the whole album was made at my house, actually. So it was very easy for me to do lead vocals and just engineer myself. And so that was done basically, let's say, February to summertime 2020, all the vocals went down.
Mm-hmm.
I did some amount of rewriting and actually limitation of sort of the image set and reduced kind of the total word, so to speak, on the album. And so there's a lot of sewing together of songs and some theming about architecture and light and battles, and sort of a limited set of emotions that are actually on the record on purpose, so that it has kind of a palette that's curated. It's not just whatever I wanted to say song by song. It's all sort of aligned across song.
So how long was the process from when you first, you had the lyrics recorded, you had so many tracks down, from when you first started working on this to the finished product? Because you clearly had to have some of the stuff called in, dialed in, sent in, through, even though it was in your studio, to do the mix downs and things, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, no, we basically, we did, I would say the creative work finished out in 2019.
Okay.
And then tons of the vocal tracking and, of course, what you're talking about, all the mixing and mastering happened within 2020. The only real big creative piece in 2020 was the writing of the song Waiting for the Knife, which closes the album. That was written way after everything else, specifically as a closer in approximately November 2020.
Okay. And did you do all the producing yourself? Did you bring in outside people to mix and master? Or is this something that was done basically by you?
It is mixed and mastered. It's mixed by a great guy named Chris Hughes, who lives in L.A. And then the mastering engineer is a really well-known guy, Michael Romanowski, who's in Berkeley. He lives like two miles from me, although I've never met him in person. All of the tracking engineering and the musical production was done by us. So that's basically me and Sham running a little studio in one room in my house. And then there's, you know, instruments around the house that we kind of go out and do little remote sessions to pick up, like the piano or maybe an electric guitar upstairs or something like that. But yeah, it's all made and self-produced in my studio and then sent out for mix and sent out for mastering.
With a collection of songs that employ such sonics to it, I would think that, especially being, you know, in downtime with the pandemic, you guys would be tempted to just tweak the hell out of it and just keep adding things and trying things, because technology is so contagious, addictive per se, you know, that, that you just say, well, that sounds great, but what if, you know, was there a lot of that going on? Because you've got access to probably a bank of synths and keys and everything else in there to wash over and play with this.
Yeah, yeah. No, anything is possible now. And like you're saying, it's an asset and a liability. I was really frustrated by digital recording over the last, you know, 15 years or so. And the way I try to describe it succinctly is I wouldn't know what I was doing because I couldn't tell where I was. And by that, I mean, when we were doing this the first time out, if you are sitting with another person with an acoustic guitar, you know, you're writing a song. And if you're in the band rehearsal, you know, you're arranging. If you're at the studio, you must be making a record. If you've stopped playing and, you know, the big guns have shown up and taken over the mixing board, you're probably mixing and mastering. So there were all these external cues. And what's both beautiful and terrifying about digital recording is you're always doing everything all the time, or you could do any of those steps at any time.
Right.
But, you know, I think on this time out, we did, I think because we had the ambition to deliver it, and because we were aware of those issues, we actually became pretty focused on not allowing ourselves lots of options. And even adopting, there's a certain style, I think about, there's a song called Monsters of Mercy that is the best expression of this, but I think of it as in excess style. And maybe even you could go back to the Rolling Stones, although you wouldn't know because the Rolling Stones are so sloppy. But the in excess is quite precise, right? So, but what you see them doing as producers and arrangers is giving you just a couple things that get along with each other and leave holes. There's not a lot of layering. It's not sort of four things on top of each other until you can't tell which one is which. It's quite the opposite. It's a couple of supporting items, and then there's a focus on a phrase for just a bar, or maybe a beat for two bars, maybe a drum fill, and it spotlights one image or sound, and then another, and then another. And it's that kind of linear sequence type of production that I think has saved us a little bit from ourselves, because you're right, you could always go back and do a remix, or there's always one more track. The other thing we do is we pretend, I mean, these days, sending a set of tracks out to a mix engineer very frequently means 200 tracks, or at least 100, and I've heard of more. And one thing we did here was we pretended we were making what would have been, you know, kind of a flamboyant, well-resourced album during, like, let's say, 1985.
Mm-hmm.
So you picture maybe, like, you know, Queen or Peter Gabriel or Tears for Fears, slaving two 24 tracks together. And that is kind of, that's your budget, because those guys were making really over the top, really Rococo arrangements with 48 tracks. So that's something we've done. We sort of put ourselves on a track diet. And I think that comes through in both the product and the process.
Okay. We're going to play that song, Monsters of Mercy. And one of the things that
cool.
I like about this, it is a concept album. It is proggy. It is all of the things we expect from a grandiose kind of production. But yet you do it all in little snippets of 2 to 4 minutes. Again, going back to your love of pop music. And a lot of musicians that make the kind of music you make think pop is a bad word.
Right.
You know, you've embraced the conceptual deep cut album thing, and the prog thing, but still embrace the pop sound. I mean, you don't hear Queensryche, for the most part, or Rush making short songs. They're pretty much epic pieces. This works as an epic if you want it by playing the whole album, or you can segment it very easily and still enjoy the songs. And I think that in itself is a gift and very unique.
That's so cool. Yeah, perfectly said. That's exactly what we do, is we put on the 100% pop goggles, and then we put on the 100% experimental goggles, and then we put the pop goggles back on, you know.
Well, let's put on our pop headphones, because you really need the cans on your head to hear all the nuances in all of the songs here. Again, new music, The Jenny Thing, and this is Monsters of Mercy.
got a shot for the victory. Just usher in a fresh fidelity. Coward Skinner, sipping advanced beginner. Overgrown child, are you kidding me? Well, no one needs a grown prodigy. Monsters of mercy and sinners and gods. 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 Go figure. People laughter in this king, come and killing me. To know it was to hate me, but you love me. Mercy, monster. I'm a shadow brother. I'm playing by the dumpster. In the shadow of a doubt, I've forgiven you. I wouldn't know what I'm living in. Monsters of mercy and sinners of gods. Monsters of mercy and sinners and gods. Monsters of mercy and sinners and gods. Monsters of mercy and sinners and gods.
New music, The Jenny Thing. Matt Easton is my guest, and that is Monsters of Mercy, one of the tracks off this. This band, in my opinion, is the evolution of bands like Nine Inch Nails and Gong and some of the great prog rock bands, Genesis, Peter Gabriel, bringing that pioneering sound to today. I'm really loving this album a lot, and it makes me think science fiction, makes me think of great film soundtracks. Matt, what kind of films are you into? Have you done film work? I can hear your sound. I can hear your playing, you personally, doing scores and doing great modern films.
Yeah, I've done just a little bit of documentary work and some kind of screwing around with friends, you know. But actually, a friend of mine has a movie on deck and has earmarked Aromatica, you know, the music, not the dialogue.
Uh-huh.
Of course, he has his own dialogue. but to go into that film, which is super exciting. But yeah, it's I'm really sort of re-stretching out into that right now and you know, building up some quirky synth stuff and some sort of signature sounds that are pulling on and based on what you hear in Aromatica and Waiting for the Knife and some other stuff here and then other stuff we haven't put out yet. So yeah, I'm on that track for sure. I feel like a slight film dummy. I sort of have these big holes in my pop culture knowledge, but I mean, some of the stuff that I love these days is, you know, Mad Men, Succession, some of these like long arc, dark psychology, sort of family breakdowns, you know, sort of things and what they do with the music in those shows, which is actually often quite minimalist. It's mm-hmm. sort of motif based. And then a lot of it is kind of sound design. So I do think I'll be embracing sort of this sound design meets film score meets composition kind of discipline. I see that in my future for sure.
I can certainly hear the documentary world calling you. I mean, very much like Tomita or Vangelis or some of those artists have provided some incredible scores for some of the most magnificent documentaries. And the music is subtle. It's not the forefront, but it makes the documentary. And Who were your influences? You mentioned about having keyboards as a teenager in your bedroom, several keyboards. Who were you emulating? Who were you looking to back at that time?
Yeah.
Rick Wakeman, people like that were around, but the keys weren't all that prominent.
Right, right. Yeah, well, I mean, Vangelis, for sure. I mean, I still, I'm actually sitting in my car right now, and I know in the CD changer I've got both Blade Runner and Chariots of Fire right now. And I listened to the backside of Chariots of Fire. I don't know if you've listened to that before, but it's kind of a 20-minute, very little repeats. It's this whole landscape in a single track. And I mean, I probably listened to that 400 times as a 10-year-old. So that definitely was on my radar from the jump here. From the time I knew what a synthesizer was. But yeah, other than that, I mean, I really liked a lot of, and I still do like a lot of kind of twee pop, like sort of the radio pop that was synth heavy at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So like I was really into, Tears for Fears, OMD, Skritti Politti, Book of Love, A-ha. The first live concert I went to was A-ha. And so those guys really, really got to me. And looking back, I think there's a really interesting primitivism to the ability to do a lot with the machinery at the time. And so these were really well-composed backdrops for vocalizing on as a result.
Mm-hmm.
And then I do have a geekier edge of me in terms of, like, I grew up as a real pianist. So I am, familiar with Emerson, Lake and Palmer and these sorts of things. And I think about the guy that sort of put all of that together and both has those sorts of chops, but he's not particularly experimental. He's just kind of choppy, and that's Howard Jones. Who's such a lovely human being and has really written songs I think for almost like a higher purpose forever. It's just like we didn't kind of know it at the time. And he got lumped in, I think, with people who were playing more computerized music. And it's interesting to look back, I think, through the lens that he was really a singer-songwriter first. And you can almost hear the fact that he wanted to be in a band. He just happened to not be in a band during a lot of those times. But he's somebody who I think did a really lovely job of writing pop with a really aggressive synthesis experimental sort of spirit. But those would be some big hits from back in the day. Okay. Well, I think about the Thompson Twins too. There's something about the Thompson Twins. They're kind of cheesy, but like it really felt like they were tapping into something big.
Well, Howard Jones, I like that because he's so under the radar and so underappreciated. He and Thomas mm-hmm. Dolby, other than Blinded Me with Science, he made some excellent music, but that's the only one people know him for.
Right. These are really ambitious people building up a body of work over decades who are brilliant. And they are kind of like one-hit wonders also, by the way. But,
It's okay to have a hit. It's okay to have a hit. But, create a great body of work, and I think that's the trajectory you're on here. With the Jenny thing, first of all, what's with the name? Who is Jenny, and what is the Jenny thing?
Right. Yeah, no, the Jenny thing is just sort of a fluke of statistics, I think, overall. But when we were, 19, walking down the street in Berkeley, I think during an evening, we heard this sort of like, oh, yeah, Jenny has a thing for that guy. And then, new conversation.
Oh.
Did you hear about the thing with Jenny? And then a new conversation. And, oh, yeah, he had always had a thing for her. He always had a thing for Jenny. And so we sort of came upon this, sort of faux, mystical thing. Like, what is this Jenny thing we keep hearing about? And it ends up being the name of our band. And here we are talking about it,
Right. It's kind of like something about Mary. Something about Mary. It's like, what the hell is that about?
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. So it's, now I like to say that we just call the four of us the Jenny thing.
All right. With this album now out, I got to say, first of all, the packaging is beautiful. The photography, the graphics, everything about this just screams a major label. But it looks like you guys did it your own.
We did. I had a wonderful team of people I worked with. I should shout them out. And Heather Hughes headed up all the assembly and the layout. And then I had two really generous and killer artists. One is Olivier Riquelme, who's a French guy who lives in LA. We met him in the desert shooting the video for the title track. And not only did he take like 3,000 pictures of us and the desert and the video shoot and the horses and the dogs and everything, but he opened up his archive as a passionate desert photographer, which is like one of the things he does. He does many things. He's an actor. He was a model. He's a writer. He's a fabulous guy, but he has this archive of desert photography, not to mention downtown LA photography. And he let us mine into that. And so we were able to continue to build out this imagery around this real / imagined place called American Canyon. So that's part of what you see in that. And then the other thing that you see is that we have this guy named Chris Homel, and he did some of the motion work, like sort of cleanup and maybe some digital effects on our video. But he and I hit it off and had another conversation about his work as a painting artist and as a 3D artist in still imagery, but digital. And so I brought him in, and he and I had a number of sessions conceiving of this flying, metallic, throbbing sea urchin that you see in the art.
Mm-hmm.
And so the sea urchin is this sort of symbol of the nemesis that is always at the other edge of your level of you know, self-esteem or ability or mental health. However you're doing, it's doing the opposite. And it's haunting you. So it goes from being a beautiful little bottom of the sea, little mermaid type, you know, background creature, and then it can fly and drop its tentacles out. And
it looks and, like grab you kind of like a black hole, like it'll suck you in. I'm looking at the at the cover. Yeah. The guy is standing there staring at it. It's almost like, yeah, just step another foot and I'll suck you right into the black hole here. Interesting.
Right, right. And what was beautiful about it was, so I'm working with a photo archive that includes none of that. So that photo was taken without that in mind a couple of years ago before I met Olivier. And I mined through his archive and then brought it together with Chris. And then he and I did the sort of psychological concepting. And then he turned it into an object. And then we started putting the object into these photos where you might say it doesn't belong at all, but it sort of looks like the right thing in the right place.
Right.
Like, you have this guy looking out like he's going to get plucked off a skyscraper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like the back cover. It's one lone rider with an empty horse. Like the war has happened and this is what's left. That half are gone or half and half is here. It just gives you that kind of self-interpretation of what you bring into it. Last question is, now that the album is out, are you guys going to be able to tour? What are you going to do? Are you going to do just videos to promote this?
Yeah, we've got the video coming. Actually, the video is dropping today. I think like this hour, the video is coming out. So people should check YouTube and check out the video for American Canyon for us, The Jenny Thing. And then, of course, our website's thejennything.com. But yeah, as far as like how we perform and everything, these days we've got sort of an electronic duo method of performing, which we might expand out into a bigger format, semi-electronic thing. And we've done some appearances, both tape and then live streaming. And we would be able to do, you know, two of us could fit in a car and show up somewhere and do a set with that too. So we have a way of playing live electronic right now. And then, you know, you punched right through to where I'm headed without even asking, which is there's a number of film possibilities that I'm working through with two or three different people, and they may include writing music. They may include actually developing a script or doing music supervisor stuff. And then, of course, the band at this point, because you know we're out here doing press and stuff, which often features me as the spokesperson. But I think the guys are pretty energized to find the next album within us and to start creating that. So that's on the table too. So there's a lot of ways that we'll start moving forward as soon as this album's out.
Okay. Well, I hear music coming under me. That means we're out of time. Thank you so much, Matt, for being with me today and then sharing all those things about the Jenny thing.
Tom, it was a pleasure to be on the show, and thank you so much.
All right. Stay in touch with Facebook, The Jenny Thing, or thejennything.com. Stay with us. Chef Nick coming up next with Let's Eat. He's got some tasty guests.